Section 2. The Greed for Surplus Labour. Manufacturer and Boyard. Capital has not invented surplus labour. Wherever a part of society possesses the monopoly of the means of production, the labourer, free or not free, must add to the working time necessary for his own maintenance an extra working time in order to produce the means of subsistence for the owners of the means of production. Footnote. Those who labour in reality feed both the pensioners, called the rich, and themselves. Edmund Burke. End of footnote. Whether this proprietor be the Athenian well-to-do man, Etruscan theocrat, Roman citizen, Norman baron, American slave owner, Wallachian boyard, modern landlord, or capitalist. Footnote. Niebuhr, in his Roman History, says very naively, "It is evident that works like the Etruscan, which in their ruins astound us, presuppose in little states lords and vassals." Sismondi says far more to the purpose, that Brussels lace presupposes wage lords and wage slaves. End of footnote. It is, however, clear that in any given economic formation of society, where not the exchange value but the use value of the product predominates, surplus labour will be limited by a given set of wants, which may be greater or less, and that here no boundless thirst for surplus labour arises from the nature of the production itself. Hence, in antiquity, overwork becomes horrible only when the object is to obtain exchange value in its specific independent money form, in the production of gold and silver. Compulsory working to death is here the recognized form of overwork. Only read Diodorus Siculus, footnote. One cannot see these unfortunates, in the gold mines between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Arabia, who cannot even have their bodies clean, or their nakedness clothed, without pitying their miserable lot. There is no indulgence, no forbearance for the sick, the feeble, the aged, for woman's weakness. All must, forced by blows, work on until death puts an end to their sufferings and their distress. Diodorus. End of footnote. Still, these are exceptions in antiquity. But as soon as people, whose production still moves within the lower forms of slave labour, corvée labour, etc., are drawn into the whirlpool of an international market dominated by the capitalistic mode of production, the sale of their products for export becoming their principal interest, the civil horrors of overwork are grafted onto the barbaric horrors of slavery, serfdom, etc. Hence the Negro labour in the southern states of the American Union preserved something of a patriarchal character so long as production was chiefly directed to immediate local consumption. But in proportion, as the export of cotton became of vital interest to these states, the overworking of the Negro, and sometimes the using up of his life in 7 years of labour, became a factor in a calculated and calculating system. It was no longer a question of obtaining from him a certain quantity of useful products. It was now a question of production of surplus labour itself. So it was with the corvée, for example, in the Danubian principalities, now Romania. The comparison of the greed for surplus labour in the Danubian principalities with the same greed in English factories has a special interest, because surplus labour in the corvée has an independent and palpable form. Suppose the working day consists of 6 hours of necessary labour and 6 hours of surplus labour. Then the free labourer gives the capitalist every week 6 times 6, or 36 hours of surplus labour. It is the same as if he worked 3 days in the week for himself, and 3 days in the week gratis for the capitalist. But this is not evident on the surface. surplus labour and necessary labour glide one into the other. I can, therefore, express the same relationship by saying, for example, that the labourer in every minute works 30 seconds for himself and 30 for the capitalist, etc. It is otherwise with the corvée. The necessary labour which the Wallachian peasant does for his own maintenance is distinctly marked off from his surplus labour on behalf of the boyard. The one he does on his own field, the other on the seigneurial estate. Both parts of the labour time exist, therefore, independently, side by side, one with the other. In the corvée, the surplus labour is accurately marked off from the necessary labour. This, however, can make no difference with regard to the quantitative relation of surplus labour to necessary labour. 3 days surplus labour in the week remain 3 days that yield no equivalent to the labourer himself, whether it be called corvée or wage labour. But in the capitalist, the greed for surplus labour appears in the straining after an unlimited extension of the working day. In the boyard, more simply, in a direct hunting after days of corvée. Footnote. That which follows refers to the situation in the Romanian provinces before the change effected since the Crimean War. End of footnote. In the Danubian principalities, the corvée was mixed up with rents in kind and other appurtenances of bondage, but it formed the most important tribute paid to the ruling class. Where this was the case, the corvée rarely arose from serfdom. Serfdom much more frequently, on the other hand, took origin from the corvée. Footnote. This holds likewise for Germany, and especially for Prussia east of the Elbe. In the 15th century, the German peasant was nearly everywhere a man who, while subject to certain rents paid in produce and labour, was otherwise at least practically free. The German colonists in Brandenburg, Pomerania, Silesia, and eastern Prussia were even legally acknowledged as free men. The victory of the nobility in the Peasants' War put an end to that. Not only were the conquered South German peasants again enslaved. From the middle of the 16th century, the peasants of eastern Prussia, Brandenburg, Pomerania, and Silesia, and soon after, the free peasants of Schleswig-Holstein were degraded to the condition of serfs. Moreg, Fronhofer, Meizen, Der Boden des Preußischen Staats, Hansen, Leibeigenschaft in Schleswig-Holstein, Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. This is what took place in the Romanian provinces. Their original mode of production was based on community of the soil, but not in the Slavonic or Indian form. Part of the land was cultivated in severalty as freehold by the members of the community. Another part, ago publicus, was cultivated by them in common. The products of this common labour served partly as a reserve fund against bad harvests and other accidents, partly as a public store for providing the costs of war, religion, and other common expenses. In course of time, military and clerical dignitaries usurped, along with the common land, the labour spent upon it. The labour of the free peasants on their common land was transformed into corvée for the thieves of the common land. This corvée soon developed into a servile relationship, existing in point of fact, not in point of law, until Russia, the liberator of the world, made it legal under pretense of abolishing serfdom. The code of the corvée, which the Russian general Kiselev proclaimed in 1831, was of course dictated by the boyards themselves. Thus Russia conquered with one blow the magnates of the Danubian provinces, and the applause of liberal cretins throughout Europe. According to the Règlement Organique, as this code of the corvée is called, every Wallachian peasant owes to the so-called landlord besides a mass of detailed payments in kind, 1. 12 days of general labour, 2. 1 day of field labour, 3. 1 day of wood carrying, in all 14 days in the year. With deep insight into political economy, however, the working day is not taken in its ordinary sense, but as the working day necessary to the production of an average daily product, and that average daily product is determined in so crafty a way that no cyclops would be done with it in 24 hours. In dry words, the règlement itself declares with true Russian irony that by 12 working days one must understand the product of the manual labour of 36 days, by 1 day of field labour 3 days, and by 1 day of wood carrying in like manner 3 times as much. In all, 42 corvée days. To this had to be added the so-called jobagie, service due to the lord for extraordinary occasions. In proportion to the size of its population, every village has to furnish annually a definite contingent to the jobagie. This additional corvée is estimated at 14 days for each Wallachian peasant. Thus, the prescribed corvée amounts to 56 working days yearly. But the agricultural year in Wallachia numbers, in consequence of the severe climate, only 210 days, of which 40 for Sundays and holidays, 30 on an average for bad weather, together 70 days, do not count. 140 working days remain. The ratio of the corvée to the necessary labour, 56/84, or 66 2/3%, gives a much smaller rate of surplus value than that which regulates the labour of the English agricultural or factory labourer. This is, however, only the legally prescribed corvée. And in a spirit yet more liberal than the English Factory Acts, the Règlement Organique has known how to facilitate its own evasion. After it has made 56 days out of 12, the nominal day's work of each of the 56 corvée days is again so arranged that a portion of it must fall on the ensuing day. In 1 day, for example, must be weeded an extent of land which, for this work, especially in maize plantations, needs twice as much time. The legal day's work for some kinds of agricultural labour is interpretable in such a way that the day begins in May and ends in October. In Moldavia, conditions are still harder. "The 12 corvée days of the Règlement Organique," cried a boyard drunk with victory, "amount to 365 days in the year." Footnote. Further details are to be found in E. Reignolt's Histoire politique et sociale des Principautés Danubiennes, Paris, 1855. End of footnote. If the Règlement Organique of the Danubian provinces was a positive expression of the greed for surplus labour which every paragraph legalised, the English Factory Acts are the negative expression of the same greed. These acts curb the passion of capital for a limitless draining of labour power by forcibly limiting the working day by state regulations, made by a state that is ruled by capitalist and landlord. Apart from the working-class movement that daily grew more threatening, the limiting of factory labour was dictated by the same necessity which spread guano over the English fields, the same blind eagerness for plunder that in the one case exhausted the soil, had, in the other, torn up by the roots the living force of the nation. Periodical epidemics speak on this point as clearly as the diminishing military standard in Germany and France. Footnote. In general, and within certain limits, exceeding the medium size of their kind is evidence of the prosperity of organic beings. As to man, his bodily height lessens if his due growth is interfered with, either by physical or local conditions. In all European countries in which the conscription holds, since its introduction the medium height of adult men and generally their fitness for military service has diminished. Before the Revolution, 1789, the minimum for the infantry in France was 165 centimetres. In 1818, Law of March the 10th, 157. By the Law of March the 21st, 1832, 156 centimetres. On the average in France, more than half are rejected on account of deficient height or bodily weakness. The minimum standard in Saxony was, in 1780, 178 centimetres. It is now 155. In Prussia, it is 157. According to the statement of Dr. Meyer in the Bavarian Gazette, May the 9th, 1862, the result of an average of 9 years is that in Prussia, out of 1,000 conscripts, 716 were unfit for military service, 317 because of deficiency in height, and 399 because of bodily defects. Berlin, in 1858, could not provide its contingent of recruits. It was 156 men short. J. von Liebig, Die Chemie in ihrer Anwendung auf Agrikultur und Physiologie, 1862. End of footnote. The Factory Act of 1850, now in force, 1867, allows for the average working day 10 hours, that is, for the first 5 days, 12 hours, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., including half an hour for breakfast and an hour for dinner, and thus leaving 10.5 working hours, and 8 hours for Saturday, from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., of which half an hour is subtracted for breakfast. 60 working hours are left. 10.5 for each of the first 5 days, 7.5 for the last. Footnote. The history of the Factory Act of 1850 will be found in the course of this chapter. Certain guardians of these laws are appointed factory inspectors, directly under the Home Secretary, whose reports are published half-yearly by order of Parliament. They give regular and official statistics of the capitalistic greed for surplus labour. Footnote. I only touch here and there on the period from the beginning of modern industry in England to 1845. For this period I refer the reader to Condition of the Working Class in England, von Friedrich Engels, Leipzig, 1845. How completely Engels understood the nature of the capitalist mode of production is shown by the factory reports, reports on mines, etc., that have appeared since 1845. And how wonderfully he painted the circumstances in detail is seen on the most superficial comparison of his work with the official reports of the Children's Employment Commission, published 18 to 20 years later, 1863 to 1867. These deal especially with the branches of industry in which the Factory Acts had not, up to 1862, been introduced. In fact, are not yet introduced. Here, then, little or no alteration had been enforced by authority in the conditions painted by Engels. I borrow my examples chiefly from the free trade period after 1848, that age of paradise, of which the commercial travellers for the great firm of free trade, blatant as ignorant, tell such fabulous tales. For the rest, England figures here in the foreground because she is the classic representative of capitalist production, and she alone has a continuous set of official statistics of the things we are considering. End of footnote. Let us listen, for a moment, to the factory inspectors. The fraudulent mill owner begins work a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, before 6 a.m., and leaves off a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, after 6 p.m. He takes 5 minutes from the beginning and from the end of the half-hour nominally allowed for breakfast, and 10 minutes at the beginning and end of the hour nominally allowed for dinner. He works for a quarter of an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less, after 2 p.m. on Saturday. Thus his gain is before 6 a.m. 15 minutes, after 6 p.m. 15 minutes, at breakfast time 10 minutes, at dinner time 20 minutes, total daily 60 minutes. 5 days, 300 minutes. On Saturday, before 6 a.m., 15 minutes, at breakfast time 10 minutes, after 2 p.m., 15 minutes, total 40 minutes. Total weekly, 340 minutes, or 5 hours and 40 minutes weekly, which, multiplied by 50 working weeks in the year, allowing 2 for holidays and occasional stoppages, is equal to 27 working days. Footnote. Suggestions, etc., by Mr. L. Horner, Inspector of Factories, in Factories Regulation Acts. Ordered by the House of Commons to be printed, 1859. 5 minutes a day's increased work, multiplied by weeks, are equal to 2.5 days of produce in the year. Footnote. Reports of the Inspector of Factories for the half-year, October 1856. An additional hour a day gained by small instalments before 6 a.m., after 6 p.m., and at the beginning and end of the times nominally fixed for meals is nearly equivalent to working 13 months in the year. Crises during which production is interrupted and the factories work short time, that is, for only part of the week, naturally do not affect the tendency to extend the working day. The less business there is, the more profit has to be made on the business done. The less time spent in work, the more of that time has to be turned into surplus labour time. Thus, the factory inspector's report on the period of the crisis from 1857 to 1858, it may seem inconsistent that there should be any overworking at a time when trade is so bad, but that very badness leads to the transgression by unscrupulous men. They get the extra profit of it. In the last half-year, says Leonard Horner, 122 mills in my district have been given up. 143 were found standing. Yet overwork is continued beyond the legal hours. For a great part of the time, says Mr. Howell, owing to the depression of trade, many factories were altogether closed, and a still greater number were working short time. I continue, however, to receive about the usual number of complaints that half or three-quarters of an hour in the day are snatched from the workers by encroaching upon the times professedly allowed for rest and refreshment. The same phenomenon was reproduced on a smaller scale during the frightful cotton crisis from 1861 to 1865. Footnote. The violations of the Acts became more numerous during the last half-year, 1863. It is sometimes advanced by way of excuse, when persons are found at work in a factory, either at a meal hour or at some illegal time, that they will not leave the mill at the appointed hour, and that compulsion is necessary to force them to cease work, cleaning their machinery, etc., especially on Saturday afternoons. But if the hands remain in a factory after the machinery has ceased to revolve, they would not have been so employed if sufficient time had been set apart specially for cleaning, etc., either before 6 a.m., sick, or before 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons. Footnote. With what fanaticism, according to the evidence of manufacturers given in courts of law, their hands set themselves against every interruption in factory labour, the following curious circumstance shows. In the beginning of June, 1836, information reached the magistrates of Dewsbury, Yorkshire, that the owners of 8 large mills in the neighbourhood of Batley had violated the Factory Acts. Some of these gentlemen were accused of having kept at work 5 boys between 12 and 15 years of age, from 6 a.m. on Friday to 4 p.m. on the following Saturday, not allowing them any respite except for meals, and 1 hour for sleep at midnight. And these children had to do this ceaseless labour of 30 hours in the shoddy hole, as the hole is called, in which the woollen rags are pulled in pieces, and where a dense atmosphere of dust, shreds, etc., forces even the adult workman to cover his mouth continually with handkerchiefs for the protection of his lungs. The accused gentlemen affirm, in lieu of taking an oath, as Quakers they were too scrupulously religious to take an oath, that they had, in their great compassion for the unhappy children, allowed them 4 hours for sleep. But the obstinate children absolutely would not go to bed. The Quaker gentlemen were mulcted in £20. Dryden anticipated these gentry. Fox, full fraught in seeming sanctity, that feared an oath, but like the devil would lie, that looked like Lent, and had the holy leer, and durst not sin, before he said his prayer. End of footnote. The profit to be gained by it, overworking in violation of the Act, appears to be, to many, a greater temptation than they can resist. They calculate upon the chance of not being found out, and when they see the small amount of penalty and costs, which those who have been convicted have had to pay, they find that if they should be detected there will still be a considerable balance of gain. In cases where the additional time is gained by a multiplication of small thefts in the course of the day, there are insuperable difficulties to the inspectors making out a case. These small thefts of capital from the labourer's meal and recreation time, the factory inspectors also designate as petty pilferings of minutes, snatching a few minutes, or, as the labourers technically called them, nibbling and cribbling at meal times. It is evident that in this atmosphere the formation of surplus value by surplus labour is no secret. "If you allow me," said a highly respectable master to me, "to work only 10 minutes in the day overtime, you put £1,000 a year in my pocket." Moments are the elements of profit. Nothing is, from this point of view, more characteristic than the designation of the workers who work full-time as full-timers, and the children under 13 who are only allowed to work 6 hours as half-timers. The worker is here nothing more than personified labour time. All individual distinctions are merged in those of full-timers and half-timers. Footnote. This is the official expression both in the factories and in the reports. End of footnote.